Businesses have a responsibility throughout their entire value chains to respect human rights. If you can apply pressure at the top of the supply chain strategically, then you can achieve change at the bottom.
You are listening to Radio Atticus,
your national program on the law in the name of social justice.
This is obviously a live issue, and we need to start to talk about how we might regulate it here so that we aren't outsourcing our problems.
People are curious. They look at you and they want to know your story.
Radio Atticus, more than the vibe.
Hello and welcome to your regular program which tackles legal stories as it crosses over issues of justice and your daily life. Here on Radio Atticus, I'll be taking you to this journey and Maria Reyes, your host, in this edition, the latest on Syria. 80 children were among those 126 killed at the recent suicide bomb attack on a convoy trying to evacuate to Aleppo. UNICEF has called the incident horrific and called for more focus on the children in crisis. So we revisit an interview in April this year following a chemical attack on the northern region of Idlib in Syria, where 546 were injured as a result, with at least 27 children confirmed dead. I speak to Felicity Weaver, who is the head for the international programs for UNICEF. Just an advance warning, there may be some strong content in this interview.
27 children are confirmed killed in the attack in Idlib. The casualty figures were last reported at 546 people, among them many children that have been injured, although we expect those casualty figures to rise.
Why do you think that the figures may rise, the casualty?
The area is fairly hard to reach, so we have 3 mobile clinics and 4 mobile hospitals that are providing the first aid and treatment. We also have ambulances going out to affected areas and bringing patients into the hospitals in the area. So as people kind of come to our attention, they'll be coming in for treatment.
Are you able to describe quickly, Felicity, what are the roles of those different parts of your work? The mobile clinics, also mentioned the hospitals.
So UNICEF's delivering critical medical supplies and working with health partners on the ground to raise awareness about medical responses to chemical attacks like this. But we're also making sure there's accessible medical care in the areas affected. So the medical clinics are quite important, the mobile clinics that can get out to where the people are, as well as hospitals for more serious kind of surgeries or attention. They're providing first aid and treatment, but also ambulances being able to refer and transfer patients who are in need of hospital treatment.
Are you able to just let us know where did these chemical attacks come from and how, in what form it happened?
I don't really have that information. I'm sorry, we're not getting those reports from our UNICEF colleagues.
So are you able to tell us then how you're able to establish that this is actually a chemical attack?
We have people on the ground and there's ongoing investigations that are going on.
All you know at this stage is about 546 people, that's now the casualties, and 27 are children?
27 children have been confirmed killed in the attack. There's a further 546 casualties who've been injured. Among them are many children.
Do we know in terms of where the attacks are taking place in Idlib, so you know where to deliver support and aid?
Yes. So UNICEF's responding in the area close to Idlib in northwest Syria. We also have ongoing work across Syria where the violence has escalated in a number of places around Damascus, obviously ongoing work around Aleppo as well. While this most recent attack is what's kind of brought it to our screen and our attention, and it's indeed horrific, we have been concerned for some time about escalating violence across different areas of Syria, and of course many thousands of people still in besieged areas where we don't have humanitarian access.
Do we know also who's the party, which countries are involved in this conflict?
I'm not across the very complex political situation. There's many parties involved in the conflict in Syria, a very complex environment. So we're working as much as we can to respond to those in need, despite not knowing all the details about how the conflict's rolling out.
In terms of the situation of the children, how are they being protected at the moment?
Yeah, so within Syria, we know that children are extremely vulnerable. They're being impacted by the crisis in many ways. We know that there's 2.3 million children, registered Syrian refugee children, who are on the move. It's an unprecedented movement of children. So those who are fleeing their homes, you know, requiring urgent assistance in that way. We also have those who are still in areas affected by the conflict, and UNICEF's continuing to work in areas of providing safe water, education, nutrition, and also providing psychosocial support programs for children who are affected by the trauma of war. The war's been ongoing for 6 years, and many children are growing up in being exposed to violence on a weekly basis. So we are trying to ensure that those children have the best possible chance to really deal with that trauma and get on with their lives in the best way they can.
So I just want to understand a little bit better how we in the West, and especially our aid organizations, are providing support. So we're providing food, that's pretty easy to understand. We're providing water and we're providing shelter. Are you saying that there might be camps that they can find sanctuary?
There's camps that are for those people on the move in many countries right around Syria. And of course, you know, this unprecedented crisis of people on the move is drawing attention all over. We're seeing huge floods of people even up into Europe. So aid organisations are really stretched in dealing with that number of people who are in camps and who are completely reliant on humanitarian care. At the same time, you know, we're continuing to work inside Syria because we're concerned about children who are staying, that they are still being able to go to school and that they are reached with psychosocial care and protected from violence.
Can you just give me an idea as well, Felicity, if that's okay? What's psychosocial? What happens with psychosocial care?
Can happen in many ways. So it could be through the school system, so training teachers in psychosocial first aid so that they can be just on the lookout for children who may be experiencing extreme trauma. It also happens in the camps in the form of child safe spaces, the places that children can go where they can play, where they can read books, where they can do the things that children need to do and have people on hand that they can talk to and receive counselling.
So, for example, if they're remembering sad things or horrible things and they're upset, usually how are the teachers trained to deal with that with the children in class?
Yeah, so teachers are often trained in psychosocial first aid, so just allowing children to be able to talk about what it is they're seeing, what's upsetting them. They often use, you know, art or drawings, and they may have resources provided like books that are written with stories about children who've gone through difficult things and how they deal with those.
Also, can I just get an idea in terms of the movement? It would seem, even from where we are and hearing some update reports, that things could get worse. Is there concern from your team and the other aid organisations, obviously, that's on the ground, that communication might get cut off? And what are the contingency plans if it does?
Yeah, UNICEF's been working in Syria for quite some time and constantly monitoring the situation, see which areas they're able to work in, negotiating humanitarian access into areas where people are affected. But it is a constantly changing environment. It's quite dangerous and it's a really difficult environment to work in. We do have quite strong kind of systems in place around security and logistics, but of course in a situation like this it's very hard to predict what might happen.
And in terms of your workers on the ground, for example UNICEF, how does it make sure that the workers are also taken care of?
It's a very hard environment for our staff, for our workers, but UNICEF does have systems in place to really provide care and support for those workers, that they're a very committed bunch of people to be working in that environment and seeing the kind of trauma that they're seeing in people who are directly impacted. But I think the commitment of those aid workers, I take my hats off to them.
We're getting some really, like you said, disturbing coverage of what's happening there. Statements coming from the new president of the US. Should Australians pay attention to this? Is this really serious that we should be paying attention to it?
Look, I think Australians should be aware of what's happening in Syria and in the surrounding countries. This war has been ongoing for 6 years now, and it tends to drop off our TV screens unless there's kind of really horrific incidences and atrocities like this. But the attacks on schools and airstrikes on densely populated areas is an ongoing issue. And I think we should all be calling on our governments and those who are in power to bring this war to an end, but also to be supporting the organisations who are in there working tirelessly for children and families who are the innocent victims of this war.
Within the UN United Nations Conventions, what are the most important things that we should remember about the rights of children?
The Convention on the Rights of the Child says that all children deserve to be protected. They have the right to protection, particularly in war. Seen in this particular conflict, children being recruited as soldiers, children being exposed to violence in schools, attacks on schools and hospitals and playgrounds and areas where they should be able to feel safe. So we do call on governments and parties to the conflict to really ensure that children's rights are protected, their right to be able to grow up in a safe environment.
Has Syria actually signed the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child?
Yes, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is the most widely ratified of all the conventions, and I believe that has been signed by Syria.
Felicity Weaver there, Head of International Programs at UNICEF, and ending that interview on Update with Syria. You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Anna Marie Reyes.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
So what's happening this week?
Have you ever seen laser beams in the sky?
What were you thinking?
I find an opportunity to lick Richard Wilkins.
Okay. Interviews and discussions and all sorts of interesting things. 107.3.
2SER.
The City of Sydney is seeking community members to join the Inclusion Advisory Panel. Can you provide expert advice about improving inclusion for people with disability to help with planning, policy development, sustainability and community consultation? Your expertise in the disability field will be highly valued. Applications close 5 p.m. Friday the 29th of September 2017. Visit cityofsydney.newsouthwales.gov.au/inclusion or call 9265 9333. Sponsors of 2SER.
Do you believe in equality and believe everyone deserves the chance to marry the person they love? Hi there, I'm Jeff Field, 2SER's News Director, and I'm urging you to vote yes in the postal ballot asking you whether you believe Australia's Marriage Act should be changed. 2SER is a proud supporter of marriage equality and encourages all fair-minded people to do the right thing. The LGBTIQ community is hoping for equality before the end of the year, and with your help, it might just happen.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
Well, I'm Gillian Triggs, and for legal news, facts and opinion, listen to Radio Atticus on 2SER.
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
2SER 107.3, and this week we're probing the dark recesses of the mind.
Oogum boogum.
Very scary.
Did you wet yourself?
It could happen to you.
Stick around, even if that scene does disturb you too much.
No matter how big or small the occasion, Crust Pyrmont is your go-to pizza store in the Sydney CBD for office catering. Crust Pyrmont can deliver from 1 to 150 pizzas per order, using the best equipment to make sure your gourmet pizzas are delivered fresh, hot and on time. Choose between ordering online through the Crust Pizza app or simply call the store on 9566 1933. Crust Pizza Pyrmont proudly sponsors 2SER 107.3.
There's never a dull moment in American politics.
You know that, I know that, everybody knows that.
Join Professor Ed Blakely and myself, Sean Britton, as we dissect all the goings on in Washington and from sea to shining sea in US of Ed.
So here's a man in critical crisis. This is a guy who wears the title president, but is not a president.
US of Ed is proudly made in the studios of 2SER. Subscribe on iTunes, Wooshka, or wherever you get your podcasts.
You are fake news.
Coming up is an interview about the importance of jury duty. Reporter Sophia Carvajal talks to some important people to find out if they're like most of us, trying to evade jury duty.
Jury duty. It's our civic duty that most people don't want to do. I talked to office worker Karen O'Neill about her attempt to get out of it, followed by Sheriff of New South Wales Tracy Hall about why we should comply with our civic duties.
Yeah, jury duty.
But I suppose it's part of everyone's kind of civil duty, even though everybody tries to get out.
And that's what the judge said, because I tried to get out of it, and many people did try to get out of it, and as I got in the line up to go and see the judge, he was roasting people before me, and I was thinking, oh no, my excuse isn't going to be good enough. He's going to hammer me. But I was very polite, and he was very nice to me. But he said, unfortunately, I cannot dismiss you. No. Mm-hmm. And I did get a bit rattled because, you know, they really do stare you down. And I was telling, you know, why I was essential to the office and minimal support staff, you know, and also, you know, a story about the spokes of the wheel that, you know, when the wheel keeps turning, but with some of the spokes, it doesn't turn as well, missing some of the spokes. But yes, so I was a bit anxious, and I think you could see that I was a bit rattled, but no.
Here's New South Wales Sheriff Tracy Hall on why it's so important to attend.
Look, jury service plays a central role in our justice system. It's a civic duty, and it allows members of our community to play an active role in the administration of justice. Juries are used in New South Wales District Courts and Supreme Courts to hear and determine the more serious criminal matters, hear and determine civil matters involving the large monetary claims, and they can also be used in coronial inquests.
How are people chosen for jury duty? Is it alphabetically? Is it totally random?
Oh, it's totally a random selection. There's an algorithm built into the new jury management system that we have, and that is a selection of people from a jury pool area.
So what are the fines in New South Wales for failure to attend?
There is a fine of $2,200 if you fail to attend without a reasonable excuse. If that fine is continued, it will be sent to the State Debt Recovery Office, where they will recover the funds. You can ask to have that fine waived if you've got a reasonable excuse, and can support that with some documentary evidence.
Okay, and for those people who can't go for any reason, can they apply to be excused?
If they can, there's a number of reasons to be excused from jury service that are in the Act, in the Jury Amendment Act, and you have to have good cause to be excused. And that can be, some of the reasons can be if you are under undue hardship or serious inconvenience to you or your family or public by attending, if you have a disability that makes it unsuitable, or you're incapable of effectively serving as a juror, that if there's conflict of interest or some other knowledge or acquaintance or friendship that you may have, which may result in you being perceived as lacking some impartiality as a juror. The sheriff can also consider excusing you in circumstances as if you are a sole trader or a contractor, mm-hmm. and if you have carer responsibilities, and if you're unable to read and understand English, there are other provisions, but they are the ones that are generally applied.
Here's Karen again on what actually happens in court.
When you go into the court, there's about 200 of you all in a pool. And then whenever a case is ready to pick a jury, they take about 40 of you and put you in that room. And then they ask, you know, go through a lot of a rigmarole, and then they basically just randomly pick 12. And then, of course, the prosecution can then challenge any of those potential jurors and get rid of them and then get new ones. Fortunately, I wasn't one of the random people. And when they did the one challenge, there was only one challenge. I wasn't picked to replace that one. So that was a really good bonus. Then you go back to the pool room to see if any more cases come about. And fortunately, no more cases came about, so we were all dismissed. But it takes a bit of time, though.
How long does it take? How long did it take?
Look, you can be there. That's what they said right from the word beginning. You can be there for half a day. You can be there for a full day. It really depends, because, you know, they're all there busy, but until they go to trial, the jurors aren't picked. So they might be in the courts meeting each party, but until they're ready to go to trial, which could be at any time, the juries aren't called in, but they've got to have jury ready to go in, if you know what I mean.
Do they pay you for that?
Yeah, they do. Like, it's like minimum pay. It's like $100 or something like that. Couldn't do it full-time. You couldn't be a full-time jury member.
Here's the Sheriff of New South Wales, Tracy Hall.
So if you are selected as a juror, you will be paid an allowance. Now, this is not intended... The payment is intended to reduce your any financial hardship you may incur as being a juror. However, it's not intended to be equal or to your normal wage or salary. Today, the current daily rate for jurors between trials for 1 day to 10 days is $106.30 for all jurors. But if the trial goes from day 11 and onwards to the end of the trial, jurors who are employed will be paid a sum of $242.30 a day. However, if you're unemployed, you will still only get $106.30 a day.
What kind of questions do they ask you to determine whether you're going to be in or out?
Well, when you first go through, they basically tell you a bit about the case and they ask if you know anyone. They mention everybody involved in the case. For example, a doctor's name was mentioned and one person said, I know that doctor. Then they asked that person, they got the person to go up to see the judge to verify whether she really did know that person, the doctor, mm-hmm. you know, full name and details. And then the judge deemed that it was in actual fact the very same person, and so that she was dismissed. But when she was dismissed, she didn't just then have to go and go home. She went back to the pool room. So it's not like you're dismissed and that's your job done. You have to go back to the pool room until they officially release you. You're either on trial as a witness or you're back to the pool room until they release everyone.
Because the cases that you had, either a sexual-based assault or murder.
Yes. No, there's no murder in the one that I went through. Oh. They were all living there, but it was definitely, of the other nature, yes.
I would actually rather go to a case with murder rather than sexual assault, because the one that I went to was to do... years ago was to do with incest between a father and daughter, and she was very, very emotional. It was really, you know, it just affected me.
I think there probably would be crying in this one because obviously, you know, because of the nature of what it was. Yeah. But we heard all about the crime, and I mean in detail about the crimes, but I'm sure it would have been even more detailed if you were basically picked as one of the jury members. You know, once you get picked as a jury member, because once one jury member says, oh, I really can't do this, I've got another commitment or something like that, they have to dismiss the whole jury and they have to go through the process again.
That's why the wheels of the justice system, they just go so slowly because of those... things like that.
And that's exactly what they said. They have to then drag in, you know, many, many, like another couple of hundred people in just to fill this jury again.
There is one other thing about the jury service that I would like to emphasise for your listeners, and that is that the jury service has recently undergone a huge transformation with a new technology, which has allowed us to provide a more efficient way in which we operate and causes less burden on the life of a juror or potential jurors and their employers.
That's great. Could you give us a few examples about the new technology being used?
Certainly. Look, we've brought the jury service into the 21st century because we can offer secure online profiles which jurors can access any time during the day or night, with an option to opt into text and email notifications and receive payments electronically. We're also able to process the attending jurors much more quickly when they come into court on the day for their summons, which means that if they're not required for trial or required to be excused on that day, we can return them to their daily activities without wasting a significant amount of their day. So whilst we understand jury service can be an inconvenience on people's lives, it's also necessary to ensure our jury system is fair and transparent, and this new system allows us to make the jury journey a lot quicker and a lot more efficient.
That was the New South Wales Sheriff Tracy Hall and Karen O'Neill, office worker, talking about being summoned for jury duty.
I'm Michael Kirby, and you are listening to Radio Atticus. Radio Atticus is part of the Community Radio Network. I was formerly a Justice of the High Court of Australia with no time to listen to this, but now I sit glued to Radio Atticus.
You're listening to Radio Atticus, broadcast nationally through the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
A shout out to all our listeners around the country, 2Bob FM in Taree, New South Wales, 7RPH in Hobart, Tasmania, 8CCC in Alice Springs, 4NSA at Noosa Heads in Queensland and more. Thank you for your ongoing support. Radio Atticus has been with you since 2009 and we continue to power on because of you. The content you hear on Radio Atticus is not legal advice. If you need legal advice, please contact your independent legal advisor.
And that's about all we have time for in this edition. We hope you enjoy the show.
Radio Atticus is broadcast nationally to the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER.
If you want more, why not tune into our podcast on www.2ser.com/Radio Atticus.
Tune in again next week at the same time and place for your regular dose of justice and the law here on Radio Atticus. I'm Anna Marie Reyes.
And I'm Sophia Carvajal.